The UN Human Rights Office confirmed on Friday that Albanese is the first special rapporteur to be sanctioned. It called for the decisions to be reversed. Right defenders have also rallied to her defense. Washington last month imposed sanctions on 4 ICC judges due to the court's arrest warrant for Netanyahu. Analyst and political commentator Mick Napier said the U.S. sanctions against UN rapporteur Francesca Albanese exposes Washington's open hostility towards international law and human rights.
The U.S. has covered up multiple massacres and invasions, overthrowing governments, exterminations, support for the most bestial regimes. And it's covered it up with this veil of commitment to human rights that that they supposedly honour. Now we see them coming out into open banditry. We see them actively promoting the genocide, the Israeli genocide, not as onlookers, but like Britain, as active participants, providing the £2,000 bombs and other material which is used in the mass killing, and politically protecting the perpetrators. This is unprecedented, and it's the first time they've actually had to take this kind of disciplinary action against international bodies charged with protecting human rights and preserving the idea of the rule of law. It's very clear that the very notion of international law, of anything that can protect the weak against the strong, has been completely shredded. So the sanctions against this brave rapporteur, I think, simply drive the point home to more and more people.
The United Nations is warning that the hunger crisis in Gaza has reached an unprecedented level. The UN's food program says humanitarian efforts in Gaza are crippled by access restrictions imposed by Israel. The organization's deputy executive director says the situation is worse than ever since before. It says humanitarian needs were never higher and the UN access never more constrained. The WFP says a third of Gazans now go for days without eating, warning the 90,000 children are now in urgent need of treatment for malnutrition. This comes after the UN Human Rights Office said at least 800 people have been killed by Israeli forces while receiving aid in the Gaza Strip. Israeli media say the killings are deliberate and ordered by senior regime commanders. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says Israel is pushing, quote, a cruel and Machiavellian scheme to kill Palestinians in Gaza. UNRWA's chief says Gaza has become a graveyard for children and starving people under the UN's watch. In a social media post, Felipe Lazzarini said Israel is giving Gazans the choice between death by starvation or gunfire. He made a comment after the regime's forces killed 15 more people, including 9 children who were waiting in line for food in Deir al-Balah on Thursday. Since May, Israeli forces have fatally shot more than 800 civilians waiting for food near aid distribution centers. Most of the death traps have been near sites run by the so-called Humanitarian Foundation run by the United States. Palestinian Authority say settlers' attacks in the occupied West Bank has claimed the lives of more Palestinians. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah for more details. Let's take a listen.
The Palestinian Ministry of Health have declared the martyrdom of the Palestinian young man Saifuddin Mislit, 23 years old, due to severe beatings by Israeli settlers. Saifuddin was on the edges of Sinjil village, just trying to be with the Palestinians over there, with the farmers, with the Palestinians who are trying to cling on to their lands, not to lose it to a new Israeli settler outpost into the south side of the village, where the Israeli settlers, hundreds of Israeli settlers, attacked those Palestinians. And unfortunately, Saifuddin was severely beaten. And then after hours of relentless aggression by the Israeli settlers, Saifuddin was found dead on the field. The continuation of the story, Bardia, was not much better. So since hours of the early evening and until even before 30 minutes. The Palestinians have been searching for a missing youth. Another Palestinian youth have been missing in the spot only 30 minutes ago, which means after more than 8 hours. Mohammed Shalabi, also 23 years old, was found also killed on the spot in Sinjil, killed by the Israeli settlers with a gunshot wound to the chest and severe beatings to the head.
In the capital, Sana'a, tens of thousands of Yemenis gathered once again in a massive Friday demonstration to reaffirm their full support for the people of Gaza. Protesters also hailed the country's armed forces for their anti-Israeli operations and targeting Israeli-bound vessels. Yusuf Mauri has a report.
The streets of Sana'a filled with chants of solidarity and resistance as protesters condemned the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza and called for continued action against the Israeli regime.
Today, we come to this place, the vote of strong and steadfastness to support people in Gaza. And from this important place, we send the message to the enemies of the good American Israel that Palestine is our case and we will continue the war against you until you stop your criminal war and aggression in Gaza.
Demonstrators also voiced strong support for the Yemeni armed and naval forces and their operations against Israeli targets in the Red Sea. The crowd sent a direct warning to the U.S., Israel, and Britain.
We send a message to the U.S., Israel, and Britain. If you approach us from the sea, you will be attacked at sea. If you approach from air, you will be attacked and destroyed. And if you come at us from the ground, you will be burned in it.
The demonstration is part of a growing wave of Yemeni mobilization, signaling continued defiance and readiness to escalate until the aggression on Gaza comes to an end. In another Friday protest, Yemenis show support for Palestinians and praise their navy for sinking two Israeli-linked vessels this past week. More vessels will continue to sink, according to Ansarullah law officials, if they attempt to violate Yemen's law against Israeli shipping. Yusuf Mauri, Sana'a.
And now to Europe, where in the UK, protesters have gathered outside Rolls-Royce headquarters in London, accusing the British firm of being complicit in genocide in Gaza by supplying parts of Israel's F-35 jets. The protest is organized by the Campaign Against Arms Trade, which says 15% of every Israeli F-35 fighter jet is made by British companies. Our correspondent was there at the protest and spoke to some of the protesters. Let's take a listen.
Unfortunately, this country is very much is complicit as a contributor to the genocide. We've got so many companies producing parts for the weapons and things like Israeli weapons companies such as Elbit are based in this country. So British companies very much complicit in actually producing the material that's being used daily against Palestinians. And it's very, really interesting that we're here. This is Rolls-Royce, based in this building here. But next door, we have the Guardian newspaper have their offices, you know, which is an equally important part of Britain's contribution to what's happening, providing the ideological justification, and also Britain plays a role in hindering and hampering international action being taken against the criminal Israeli government.
Rolls-Royce is one of the big arms suppliers, and you know they're selling arms in the name of the British people and American people, and I object to killing being done in my name and with my tax dollars.
Yeah, we're here to tell Rolls-Royce to stop arming the Israeli regime. Their engine technologies, both made by Rolls-Royce here but also Rolls-Royce in the US and their German subsidiary, are being used in Israeli tanks, in their armored vehicles, in their warships, in their submarines, in their transport aircraft, in their spy planes, across the Israeli war machine. And we're saying that it's high time that this company stopped supplying those weapons to Israel.
It's just shameful, really, that multiple companies will turn around and support Israel in their genocidal, genocide. There's nothing else to say about it. It's just genocide, straight up and simple. We've seen genocide multiple times, and every time we see it, we always say never again, never again. When is it going to be never again?
memorial ceremony has been held in Tehran to mark the martyrdom of prominent IRGC commander Lieutenant General Mohammad Saeed Izadi, who lost his life in the recent Israeli aggression. Military and political figures paid their respect, highlighting the lasting impact of his contribution to the resistance. Farzania Shorian has reported.
A memorial ceremony in Tehran to honor the martyred IRGC commander, Lieutenant General Mohammad Saeed Izadi, a national hero who lost his life in the recent Israeli aggression against Iran. The ceremony, filled with a sense of gratitude and deep admiration, serving as a poignant occasion to remember the sacrifices he made in the fight against the Israeli regime and in strengthening the resistance front.
His name shines brightly among those who fought against the Zionist regime. His cause and ideals remain vibrant, and his blood continues to strengthen his path more than ever.
He was a remarkably strong individual, unwavering in his commitment to the ideals of the Islamic Revolution. For many years, he dedicated himself to serving the Palestinian people, and his legacy continues to endure.
Throughout his service as an IRGC commander, he collaborated closely with all the prominent figures of the resistance front. This remarkable leader worked relentlessly to gather vital knowledge and technology, fortifying the resistance movement and establishing an enduring impact in the battle against adversaries. Lieutenant General Izadi's tireless efforts in securing the necessary expertise, technology, and resources have strengthened the resistance front, leaving a lasting legacy in the fight against the enemy. Farzan Hashim, Tehran.
And that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. As always, more is on our website to keep you updated. Thank you so much for joining us. Goodbye for now.
In the vast sky of Iran's history, certain names shine like brilliant stars. Names that, through steadfastness and devotion, have earned not only victories on the battlefield, but a place in the hearts of every Iranian. The commanders of this land from ancient times to today have always stood as symbols of resistance, courage, and sacrifice. Relying on faith, knowledge, and a deep love for their homeland, they have confronted every threat and defended the honor and integrity of this nation. Commander Ghulam Ali Rashid is one of those immortal names, a man whose presence on the battlefield struck fear into the heart of the enemy and whose patriotic zeal served as an unbreakable shield for his country. A time life spent defending Iran and its ideals ultimately culminated in his martyrdom during the Zionist regime's aggression against Iran. His name is now recorded forever in the scroll of this land's glory. Born in 1953 in the city of Desful in the southern province of Khuzestan, Ghulam Ali Rashid stepped onto the path of jihad from an early age. His political activities against the Pahlavi regime reflected the determined will of this remarkable man. Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, due to his anti-regime actions, he was arrested and transferred to Ahvaz, where he served a 9-year prison sentence. That prison term became a turning point, bringing him into contact with prominent figures such as Mohsen Rezai and Ali Shamkhani, who would later become senior commanders in the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC. In 1976, he was arrested again in Isfahan and transferred to Tehran, spending yet another year in prison. But even prison walls could not contain his resolve. Upon release, he resumed his struggle with renewed strength on the front lines of truth against tyranny. Following the establishment of the IRGC, Ghulam Ali Rashid began his service as the Deputy for Intelligence and Operations in the Desful IRGC. During the Iraqi Ba'ath regime's imposed war against Iran, he rose to become one of Iran's senior commanders, playing a pivotal role in many major operations. Beyond his military service, Commander Rashid was also a leader in the realm of knowledge and education. He held a master's degree in political geography from the University of Tehran and a PhD in the same field from Tarbiyat Mudarris University. He also served as an associate professor and faculty member at both the Supreme National Defense University and Imam Hussein University, training generations of future defense scholars and officers. Elevated to the rank of Major General, he was appointed Deputy Chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces, and he also served as Deputy for Defense Affairs at the Secretariat of the Supreme National Security Council. And finally, the proud culmination of this honorable path was the martyrdom that testifies to his ultimate level of loyalty and self-sacrifice. On the morning of Friday, June 13, 2025, Commander Rashid attained martyrdom in a cowardly Israeli missile strike on Tehran, sacrificing his life in defense of the homeland he had so long protected. Throughout decades of service, his record was one of wisdom, leadership, and unmatched bravery. As one of the chief commanders of the Sacred Defense era, he played a vital role in planning and executing major, decisive military operations. His active presence on the front lines and his sensitive role, such as Deputy for Intelligence and Operations in Darfur, bear witness to his deep involvement and commitment to defending the country's borders. His ability to coordinate between the Army and IRGC at Khatam al-Anbiya headquarters, the highest operational command structure of Iran's armed forces, was a clear of reflection of his exceptional strategic and managerial capabilities. This distinguished performance made him one of the chief architects of Iran's post-revolutionary defensive power. What doubled the strength of Commander Rashid was not only his military ability, but his insight and intellectual depth. His academic background in political geography and his scientific activities in prestigious institutions gave his military analysis profound richness. He was not merely a battlefield commander, he was a thoughtful strategist who fused theoretical knowledge with experience. This combination of scholarship, experience, and foresight made him a heavyweight figure not only in combat zones, but also in strategy rooms and high-level planning sessions. His presence lent great weight to decisions and operations, making him a model of both power and prudence. In the end, the martyrdom of Commander Rashid is a cowardly act of Israeli aggression, highlighted the peak of his strength and faithfulness to the nation and its ideals. To his final breath, he wore the uniform of service and defense. His life is textbook in resistance, sacrifice, and patriotism. His brilliance and unparalleled courage remain a lasting legacy, a legacy that secures his name an eternal place in the proud history of Iran.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. And Professor Jeffrey Sachs joins us now. Professor Sachs, a pleasure, my dear friend.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you at some length about the collaboration, you can call it a plot if you want, between Israel and the United States against Iran. But before we do, can we lay to rest what the president has been saying as recently as yesterday, Sunday, on Fox Business, where he boasted once again that his bombs, and he used that phrase, totally obliterated the nuclear capabilities of Iran. Is this true or isn't it true?
No, it's plainly false. It is absolutely false. Iran did not sit around with its enriched uranium waiting for this to happen. It almost surely secreted it out to other sites. There is simply no way that a firm conclusion can be reached that this ended Iran's nuclear capacities. It did not. Now, I think it's also important to say that Iran has made perfectly clear for 20 years. And I had discussions today with a senior Iranian diplomat. They don't want atomic bombs. They don't want the burdens of them. They do not want to make themselves a target of nuclear war in that way. They do not want them, but they do not want to be overthrown by Israel's murderous government. And that is a problem. And last week was an attempt by the Israeli government, which is a rogue state, the most dangerous on the entire planet, to kill the Iranian leadership. Not only the supreme leader, but government officials as well. They succeeded in many murders, but they did not succeed in the regime change operation. Then came this U.S. bombing of these sites. It did not change anything, in my view, in the nuclear calculation, but it made everything far worse in terms of the potential. When I say didn't change anything, it didn't change anything in terms of Iran's capacity to produce atomic bombs, or, by the way, to obtain them from others. All it did was make the situation far more dangerous, because now there is no inspection taking place. The Iranians know without question that they were targeted in a very deadly regime change operation. They know that the United States was party to it. They know that European countries are basically vassal states of the United States, so won't say one word on their own. So they know that they were targeted for assassinations and regime change. That does not make the situation safer today than last week. It makes everything far more reckless and dangerous.
So I guess the answer is also no when President Trump boasts, as he did as recently as last night, that Iran was, quote, weeks away, close quote. Secretary Hegseth has said the same thing, from developing a bomb. There is no basis for that. It's just political claptrap.
If Iran wanted to make a mad dash for a bomb, it could have done so in the past. There is, as I think everybody now understands, a religious ruling many years ago that Iran does not want a bomb. There were negotiations for years where Iran said, we give over our nuclear materials, we open ourselves up to inspection, we do not want a bomb. We do not want unilateral disarmament because Israelis will murder us, period. So they don't want to be murdered by Netanyahu and his gangsters, but on the other hand, they don't want a bomb, even though Israel, of course, has many nuclear weapons. If there's a rogue state in terms of atomic weapons, it's, of course, Israel.
Why is there no national in the U.S. or international conversation about how Israel, without signing the non-proliferation treaty, without permitting any inspections, and on the basis of stolen information, has a nuclear weapon, but Iran's not permitted to have one? What kind of justice is that?
Not only does Israel have nuclear weapons, it's not only and also not part of the non-proliferation treaty, but of course there's no international verification or inspection of anything that Israel does. There is discussion all over the world, just not in the United States and its vassal states in Europe and in Israel. So this is a game. It's the ultimate double standard. But that's part of the point of empire, by the way. The American policy is not to pretend that there is a consistent line. The Americans and the Israelis, in their way, want to say, there are rules. The rules apply to you. We do anything we want and don't forget it. And that's not hidden. That's part of the whole idea. That is, we will kill you if you don't follow our rules. And we mean it. We don't have to follow them. We don't have to have international standards. But we have the rules. That's the so-called rules-based order. It means America sets the rules for others, not for itself. So there is discussion all over the world. But in the United States, there is not. And that comes back to our domestic politics. It comes back to the Zionist hold on American politics, which, remember, is as much or more a Christian evangelical movement as it is a Jewish movement. The Jewish community is more divided on this point than the Christian evangelicals, who vastly outnumber the Jews in terms of voting power and in terms of Trump's base. But there's a lot of money that is invested in making sure that the Congress of the United States is 100% subservient, and that whoever occupies the White House understands that their job is to do what Israel says.
Which country had the better outcome from the 12-day war, Iran or Israel?
Israel suffered massive losses, many direct hits in Haifa, in Beersheba, in Tel Aviv, the Iron Dome, and the other parts of the system, because that's just one component of Israel's air defense system, failed on multiple occasions. Iran has missiles that can penetrate Israel's air defenses, and Israel got hit hard, but it could have and could be in the future hit far harder. So Israel suffered a lot. Israel has no impunity in this, and will get hit harder and harder each time this is done. Israel may have told, according to some stories, I have no idea whether it's true, may have assured Trump, don't worry, it's a 24-hour operation. We murder the whole top of the government. We have a new government in place shortly. All will go well. That obviously did not happen at all, nor did the defenses work the way that the Israeli censors want us to believe. There was direct military censorship from Israel after the second or third day. We did not see all of the damage, but people posted a lot of the damage, and we know that it was extensive, and very, very real, and very dangerous for Israel. But this is also just to say that Israel's been making wars for 30 years and drawing the United States into wars for 30 years that has not improved Israel's security. This is the irony. Same with the United States. We could be the most secure country in the history of the world, and yet we're closer to nuclear Armageddon than ever because of our flagrant, blatant irresponsibility of pushing us closer to the brink because we do not play fairly at all. We cheat on everything, every day. Every day is a lie, and every day threatens to push us to the nuclear brink, whether it's with Russia or with many other countries that have nuclear weapons right now. It's the only risk we face. But we're not behaving the president and the deep state in a way which actually protects us, though we should be the safest people in the whole world. But we're absolutely, as the atomic scientists tell us in their doomsday clock, we're the closest to nuclear war. And the closest to self-destruction since the start of the nuclear age. We're just blowing it because we cannot seem to understand basic facts of how to have stable, honest, truthful, peaceful relations with other countries.
What did the United States gain by Trump's dropping of these bunker busters?
I think they wanted to try out these bombs. They wanted to look tough. Trump said it was the greatest bombing in the history of the world, or he compared it to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which itself is an amazing thing for any president to say, especially if one happens to know the history of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because the history is not as every school child has been told for the last 80 years, that it saved American lives from invading Japan at the end of World War II. That's the bunkum story. The true story is that Japan was begging to surrender. It wanted to keep the emperor. The United States said, we're going to drop the bombs first, because Truman wanted to make a big show to Stalin, mostly. Right. And it did not save any American lives, because in the end, the United States said, yes, the emperor stays anyway. Neither of those bombs needed to be dropped. But I make the point that Trump he said, no, I shouldn't make that comparison. But then he made the comparison. That's not an accident. He's bloviating. He wants to say, look at how powerful the United States is. We can do what we want. We can blow you up. So that's what he thinks he gained. But in fact, it doesn't work this way in actuality. The United States can't do what it wants. A lot of the world understands that very, very well. The more we have this bloviating, the less the United States is able to enter into any kind of serious agreement with any other country on any substantive issue. This is extremely hazardous for the American people to have a political system that is completely untrusted and untrustworthy by others.
I'm going to ask you in a minute about the nature and extent of American and Israeli collaboration against Iran. But before I do, I want you to watch a rather extraordinary video of David Barnea, you know who he is, the head of Mossad, thanking the CIA and the CIA director for all of its help. I don't know why this fellow allowed himself to be videoed doing this, unless he plans on running against Netanyahu for prime minister, but that's another topic for another time. Chris, cut number six.
I also want to express appreciation and gratitude to our main partner, the CIA, for the joint operations and the missions that were carried out, and also to the head of the CIA, who supported the Mossad in making the right decisions, which ultimately made this operation possible. We will continue to keep a very close watch on all the projects in Iran, which we know in the most thorough way, and we will be there just as we have been until now. But we must not forget that there are still 50 hostages in the Gaza Strip, 30 deceased, 20 living hostages, whom it is our moral and ethical duty to bring back to our border. I want to thank you all again, and to tell you that you are part of history, an unforgettable and inseparable part of what the Mossad has done and continues to do. Continue working shoulder to shoulder with our partners in the IDF and the Shin Bet, and in this way, we will keep bringing great achievements to the people of Israel. So thank you all very much. Well done, truly well done.
What do you make of that?
First of all, 25 hostages, and they're killing 50 to 100 innocent Palestinians every day. They're killing 50 to 100 innocent Palestinians every day by luring them to food sites and then shooting them deliberately. And we know this from testimony of IDF soldiers in recent days, carried in stories in Israeli media. They're mass murdering the Palestinians before our eyes. And this man talks about the moral and ethical responsibility. This man is a mass murderer. That's Mossad's job. Now, Mossad and the CIA have a very strong relationship. They are closely allied in many operations around the world, especially in the Middle East, but in other regions as well. And that is a very key part of American foreign policy and a very key part of the U.S.-Israel relationship. The Mossad-CIA connection goes back at least more than 60 years, we know. It's very strong, and I always emphasize it is the CIA where you find our foreign policy, not the White House especially. The CIA is the deep state. It keeps the long-term strategy, whether it's to try to weaken or overthrow governments in Russia or Iran or other places. It was the lead agency in a long war against the Syrian government that took hundreds of thousands of lives and culminated in a jihadist regime coming to power, which suddenly we declared to be our wonderful friend and ally, because in fact we run jihadists, the CIA does, and so does Mossad, contrary to what casual thought would suggest. So I'm not surprised by it, other than how clearly stated all of this is. That is just a long, professional, deadly, horrible relationship. Horrible because it has made a 4,000-kilometer swath of violence across North Africa, the Horn of Africa, the Eastern Mediterranean, and West Asia, running from Libya to Iran. This is murder incorporated, and murder, whether it's of the leaders for overthrows of government or mass murders of Palestinians, does not solve anything other than making mayhem and murder.
Is it realistic to fear that Trump will use nuclear weapons next time around?
I don't think so. I really doubt that. I think that, as I say, the United States has no security risk in the world other than a nuclear war. And I think that this is really understood by a lot of people who still make wars, who still say, oh, we're threatened by this, we're threatened by that, we're threatened by global terrorism. Remember the war on global terror and how Americans were terrorized by all of this, which was never a threat in the way that it was described. I don't believe that we're anywhere close to having a nuclear war over this. But if you push other nuclear powers like Russia or North Korea or Pakistan, you could certainly provoke a nuclear war. That is absolutely, or China, obviously, I should mention, over Taiwan, another phony issue that would never be the issue it is were it not for the provocative American positions on this. Because if it weren't for America arming Taiwan, Taiwanese politicians would never do the provocative things that they are actually doing, many of them, which bring us closer to a direct confrontation between the U.S. and China. In other words, I don't believe that this is leading to America's first use of a nuclear weapon, but I do believe it is leading us to the real possibility of a nuclear war that completely becomes a global annihilation. That, I think, is the real point I'm trying to make, which is that our foreign policy is so erratic, so irresponsible, so devoid of true international principles, so filled with a lot of BS, that that's what makes it very dangerous for us.
Would Netanyahu is he crazy enough to use nuclear weapons against Iran?
Under certain circumstances, yes. That if Israel was threatened by a massive attack by Iran that followed an attack by Israel, then yes, that's absolutely possible. And that's one of the things that could trigger a global nuclear war. And Netanyahu absolutely would. That's why Israel has them. And Israel thinks it can provoke any side. It has pretended that its Iron Dome and other air defense systems give an absolute protection to Israel. Now we see that this is completely false. And so if Israel provokes another attack, and there's a massive attack from Iran that is threatening the heart of Israel, and one can imagine many ways that that could happen, then I have no doubt that Israel would contemplate the use of one or more of its nuclear weapons. So any state threatened with survival that has nuclear weapons would do so. This is definitely true of Israel, given this mentality that is there, which is stoking up dangers because it refuses to have any kind of real diplomacy with the Arab world over the core issue that has been the core issue for 100 years, and that is the right of Palestinians that also live in the same area as Israel and that Israel is occupying. And because of that, the violence continues to soar. Israel provokes. It is not in a strong position the way that it thinks it is, and last week exposed its vulnerabilities. It counts on the United States to rescue it, but we can see that the United States may say, no, don't do that. The Israel provokes, believing that the U.S. will follow. The U.S. doesn't follow. Mass response from Iranian side, and then Israel feels that its survival is a threat, and it uses a nuclear weapon, after which there could be many scenarios of Pakistan defending Iran or North Korea or many other things that one could imagine that could then lead on to a nuclear war that would rapidly get out of hand and destroy the world. That's why every single thing that we're doing in all of this is so unbelievably dangerous and reckless. It's hard to put into words without profanity, sorry to say. And while the president uses profanity, we're not going to use profanity the same way. And the fact of the matter is we need diplomacy. We need diplomacy to end the war in Ukraine. We need diplomacy to end a potential conflict over Taiwan. And we need diplomacy to create a state of Palestine alongside a state of Israel and to end Israel's wars of regime change. Because these are the conflicts that could destroy the world, not in one step, but in one step with escalation, with retaliation, with the pressing one side to use a nuclear weapon, leading to a nuclear exchange, leading to a rapid escalation that ends the world. And there is a book that I may have mentioned in our past discussions, but I recommend it to anybody that wants a chilling and accurate account of how the world could come to an end in 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's called Nuclear War, a Scenario, by the investigative journalist Annie Jacobson. It's a superb, accurate, technical, chilling account of what I'm describing, which could happen in any of these war zones, which is why we need diplomacy, not games, not regime change operations, not Lindsey Graham our most dangerous and reckless senator, who posts game on as Israel strikes and the United States strikes Iran. Game on. This is not a game.
Professor Sachs, thank you very much. Thank you for your analysis, as painful as a lot of this is. Truly, truly and profoundly appreciated. Thank you for staying up for us. All the best.
Of course.
Again, friend. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, the middle way. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to 8 to 30 on Iron Bingish Radio. Me, Sister Zainab. And obviously the middle way is, it's another huge topic in our faith. And obviously we know that Islam is not a faith of extremes. We are all supposed to follow the middle way, the moderate path. And so neither tending to extreme on the one side nor on the other side. I'm just going to illustrate this just with a little sort of anecdote from life of one of the famous martyrs from the Holy Defense by the name of Manucher Mordek. So obviously he, like all martyrs and like the most self-reformed, the most pious amongst us Muslims and believers, didn't like extremes in his affairs, and to such an extent even that he wouldn't talk that much. And so obviously this is a different way of looking at this sort of middle way, because typically very often when we were talking about the middle way and not going towards extremes, often it seems to be centered, focused on, you're not being ostentatious, not showing off our wealth, not being overly wealthy. But of course in Islam there's no problem with people having wealth and being wealthy. It's more about what we do with it and whether we show it in an ostentatious way. So that's obvious, but obviously this idea of the moderate path has many other different sort of aspects to it. And I think maybe it's quite useful to even talk about this idea that, we don't even talk too much, because this is something that is reflected in our teachings, and the scholars tell us we're supposed to weigh our words carefully. We are not supposed to actually talk too much, because the danger is the more we talk, maybe we end up talking nonsense too. That's just something that sometimes happens. And there's other elements in there which I'll explain. Welcome back to ASED here on Arab English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea that Islam has the middle way. And I mentioned this particular attitude or behavior of the famous martyr Manucher Mordek, who wouldn't even talk too much. And maybe think about it for yourselves. What is it like? Obviously we all mix with families and friends or in the workplaces. And just think to yourselves, what is it like when you're with people and, they just don't stop talking? And then what is it like when we're with people and we understand and we can tell that they're really only sort of trying to say the most important things. So there's no sort of superfluous and silly stuff in there. And they do actually pause, because, of course, the danger is if we're talking too much, if we're extreme even in our amount of conversation, how is the other person going to even be able to converse with us? I mean, how long do they have to wait? Because obviously if we have good akhlaq, we're not supposed to sort of interrupt the other person. But if that person just talks and talks and talks, and for sure everyone knows people like that in their surroundings, family or friends or workplace, it's difficult. So this is also in a sense being kind, having politeness, being humble towards others, that we are aware, well, hang on, there's another person there. A conversation is a two-way process. It's not just about one person talking. And obviously we have to think about, we really want our words to have some significance, to be useful in the sense that maybe there's something informative and sort of educational in our words, maybe useful in that they give light to the hearts of other people. That could also be very beautiful. But let's just leave it that obviously here in the podcast I have to keep talking at you. But inshallah we can sort of be a bit more aware of that we don't just talk at over people. Inshallah. So look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio, and farewell for today. thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
May peace, blessings, and mercy from God be with you. When discussing Iran in the context of the war in June 2025, it's essential to highlight two individuals who played a key role in enhancing the chances of success for the Axis and in bringing closer the dream of liberating Palestine, the martyr Qasem Soleimani and the martyr Saeed Izadi, also known as Hajj Ramadan. General Soleimani, the former commander of the Quds Force, was the true architect behind the evolution of the resistance axis. He transformed what was once a simple defensive alliance of forces in the region into a concrete project aimed at besieging Israel and challenging American supremacy in our countries. Soleimani played a crucial role in reinforcing the two central ideas of the Axis strategy. His involvement in organizing the arms routes for the resistance in Palestine is significant and well documented by numerous statements from Palestine and Lebanese leaders. Additionally, Hajj Qasem led the mission to combat Daesh in Iraq and Syria. In doing so, he eliminated the most lethal American grip, which aimed to dismantle societies and pit forces against those who opposed hegemony and occupation in endless battles. This would allow Israel to expand discreetly and enable the United States to maintain its dominance without disruptions. By defeating Daesh, Soleimani, in collaboration with Iraqi, Syrian, and Lebanese forces, helped to strengthen the umbrella that protected the Palestinian resistance and establish a balance against the dominant American power. In all these events, the media outlets of the normalizing regimes, whether Saudi, Emirati, or Qatari, were at the forefront. They promoted the term Iranian project as an initiative aimed at occupying Arab territories and perpetrating sectarian massacres. The aim of this campaign was to create a link between the Zionist project and the so-called Iranian project, as they defined it. Their direct message to the Arab audience was, as an Arab, what is your issue with the Zionist project? It occupies territories. If that's the case, then this Iranian project also occupies four Arab capitals. And if your concern is that American hegemony imposes a lifestyle on you and erases your identity and existence, then this Iranian project turns Arab peoples into Persians, magicians, and fire worshippers. This is how media controlled by normalizing regimes instill this idea in the minds of their followers. The goal was to create a demon that was equal to and even worse than the one already known to Arabs and Muslims, Israel. In the face of a supposedly worse demon than Israel, it becomes normalized and natural to ally with the lesser demon, meaning Israel, or at least to collaborate with it to combat the Iranian project. It becomes quite common and natural to view oneself, at best, as neutral and to pray. It becomes quite common and natural to view oneself, at best, as neutral and to pray, oh God, punish the oppressors with the oppressors. This distortion of consciousness, which occurred and continues to occur under the guise of the Iranian project, is the reason why many people were left shocked after the Zionist Western aggression against Iran in June 2025, particularly following the harsh and destructive Iranian responses to the Israeli entity. However, this shock, even today, has not managed to overcome the vast amount of falsehoods and lies that have been spread about leaders of the Axis of Resistance.